everyone, and welcome to the reading of the Des Moines Register for Thursday, February 25th, 2021. I'm your reader, Dennis May. Things are changing very quickly, and IRIS wants to make sure we provide our listeners with as much information as we can. In order to do that, we've changed our program schedule completely. This schedule will air statewide on all platforms until further notice. We will also include information about resources in your community during each paper. You'll still hear your Des Moines Register each day at 9 a.m., 6 p.m., and 1 a.m. Please listen closely to the following changes for all other newspapers. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m., Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m., Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 a.m. until noon. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m., 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Midweek Shopping Cart will be read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. Recordings of all newspapers will be available on our podcast page. Just go to iowaradioreading.org, click Listen Now, then click Listen to IRIS Podcasts. The papers are organized by region, and each paper will be available for 7 days. As things continue to change, we will announce schedule changes each hour at 56 minutes past the hour going forward. Keep yourself safe, and thank you for listening. And now, let's take a look at today's weather. Our statewide AccuWeather forecast calls for it to be mostly sunny today, with the winds from the west at 6 to 12 miles per hour, with a moonlit sky tonight. And again tonight, the winds will be from the southwest at 3 to 6 miles per hour. Partly sunny tomorrow, with rain or snow shower spots in the west. The forecast for Des Moines calls for a high today of 40 degrees with a low of 26, again, some clouds, but sunny, and on Friday, a high of 45 with a low of 31, partly sunny and breezy. Across the area, some clouds, but then very sunny today. Our sunrise today was at 6:55 a.m. and will set at 6:01 p.m. The moonrise today, 4:12 p.m. and the moon set at 6:20 a.m. And now let's take a look at the headlines and the first story in today's Des Moines Register. There are three stories on the front page of today's paper: Small Town, Big Drama, Senate Passes Welfare Reform, and Senate GOP Seeks to Curb Big Tech Censorship. We'll start out with Daniel Lathrop's article, Small Town, Big Drama. Accusations, investigations have roiled Armstrong for years. The year 2020 ended well for Armstrong's then-mayor Greg Bum. He won the lottery in November, collecting more than $95,000. As it turned out, he would need the cash. Last week, facing felony charges, he posted $67,000 in bail and resigned from office. His predicament embroils other current and former officials in the unassuming town of 900 people, and has left it the subject of accusatory headlines and largely leaderless. It puts a blemish on our community that's going to be hard to erase, City Councilmember Rob Nutt said after a session on dealing with the crisis. Authorities arrested Bum, age 69, along with four other current and former officials earlier this month, charging they had bilked the city of thousands of dollars while falsifying and destroying records. Facing charges with him is his son-in-law, Craig Merrill, the chief and sole member of the town's police force. Also charged are city clerk Tracy Lang and her predecessor, Mary Catherine Stanton, as well as another former city clerk, Connie Thackeray. According to a state audit, some $90,000 in city money is unaccounted for, either uncollected or never deposited. Court filings contain an array of allegations. Bum signed and Merrill cashed checks for more than $10,000 in which he wasn't entitled. Merrill took a vacation at city expense. Thackeray, Bum, and Lang each falsified various city documents. Bum illegally barred Stanton from City Hall. Merrill took cash to shoot Stanton's boyfriend, Tyler Evans, with his city-owned taser at a party. Stanton stole city money and falsified documents. Bum, Merrill, Lang, and Thackeray face felony charges. Stanton faces misdemeanor charges. Except for Thackeray's lawyer, they have declined to comment on the charges. All but Lang have pleaded not guilty. Not talking to anyone. Thanks for the phone call, Bum told the Des Moines Register reporter on February 22nd before hanging up the phone. Thackeray's attorney, Ned Bornstad, expressed outrage at her treatment. She's just the sweetest, nicest lady. She's mad about the charges, Bornstad said. He said she had been arrested and held on cash bail over a long weekend. This lady's 67 years old. She's a lifelong resident of Northwest Iowa, sitting in jail, said Bornstad, a former prosecutor. That's just not how we do things, nor how we should do things. He said neither he nor Thackeray is clear on what she is supposed to have done, and that he's waiting for prosecutors to provide legally required discovery materials outlining their case. Townspeople were largely tight-lipped last week, declining to discuss the dilemma which involves their cousins, siblings, and old friends. The city council scrambled to figure out who would keep the local government operating. The full story may eventually come out in court. Records show Lang, who initially pleaded not guilty, then changed her plea to guilty, and Stanton have separately struck deals to cooperate with the prosecutors from the Iowa Attorney General's office. But there are glimpses of a complicated history that began long before the current troubles in a town where the business district is two blocks long, and the skyline consists of a grain elevator and a pair of water towers. Bum has long been a central figure in Armstrong. His most recent term as mayor wasn't his first, nor was it the first time questions about his conduct as a public official have come to light. As a young Armstrong police officer, he was arrested and charged with burglary in 1982 for allegedly breaking into a warehouse with three other men, according to reports at the time. Several bullets were taken from T&G Industries, the Register reported, but the city council voted to keep on paying Baum until the charges were resolved. Eventually, that case and the charges were expunged, and Baum returned to work. Then, in 1987, critics who included his then-wife accused him of dereliction of duty, leading the mayor at the time to sack him, according to another Register story. He appealed to the city council and the courts, but lost and ultimately moved to a new line of work as a carpenter. For some, that would have been the end of their public service. Yet, he would go on to serve as a school board president, fire chief, and eventually mayor. The criminal charges and investigation both date to about 2016, when Bum began his most recent stint as mayor. The city council appointed him to fill a vacancy, and Stanton, then the city clerk, swore him in. Their relationship would quickly deteriorate. It may have something to do with the April 2016 party, where, prosecutors allege, Merrill used his taser on Evans and another partier. Whatever the case, it came to a head in July, when accountants from the state auditor's office arrived to begin a routine review of the city's accounts. They found that the city's financial records had been deleted, without backups available. Stanton, who was responsible for the city's records, sending out utility bills and handling most of the day-to-day activities of City Hall, laid the problem at Bum's feet. I was gone in late July, shortly before our audit was to begin, and when I returned, my computer had completely crashed again, without having an update or any reason to lose any information. Greg Bum had access to the computer at this time, and I never fully received an explanation as to why it might have gone down at this point, she said, according to a report from the Iowa Auditor's Office. It was roughly at this time, according to charging documents, that Merrill was allowed to take what is described as an all-expense-paid vacation in addition to his city salary. In Armstrong, the police chief, clerk, and other senior city employees report directly to the mayor. As auditors discover the problems, their report shows new concerns arose. By November, members of the city council were expressing concerns that cash receipts from the city swimming pool had never been deposited, auditors reported. That same month, Emmett County Sheriff's deputies seized records and a significant amount of cash which had not been counted or deposited, the auditors reported. The auditors eventually determined it was the missing money from the pool, part of close to $90,000 in unrecorded or uncollected city fees from that year. Baum, according to prosecutors, then directed Stanton to begin falsifying documents about the city pool. It was at roughly that point that the city placed Stanton on administrative leave. As the year wrapped up, state auditors, the sheriff's office, and the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation were all probing the books. As things settled down, the city council voted in mid-April of 2017 to return Stanton to work. Just as this was happening, prosecutors charged, Baum signed, and Merrill cashed over $10,000 in fraudulent payments. Then, on April 17th, Baum locked the door to City Hall and refused to let Stanton in, preventing her from carrying out her duties, according to the charges against him. The Esterville News reported that Baum issued a letter declaring a state of high concern and instructing city employees not to have any contact with Stanton. As the conflict raged on, Stanton and Evans both left their city jobs and moved out of town. At one point that summer, the sheriff's office arrested both on minor criminal charges of disorderly conduct. The charges were dismissed following a deferred prosecution agreement in which they each paid court costs. Thackeray and then Lang both came into the picture. Lang succeeded Stanton, and prosecutors say she falsified a variety of city documents at Baum's behest. They charged that Thackeray conspired with Baum while filling in for Stanton, although they also charged the pair had conspired to falsify city documents going as far back as 2014. At this point, in late 2016 and early 2017, things got even more complicated. The sheriff's office and the Iowa DCI were simultaneously investigating possible financial misconduct and Merrill's use of his taser. They charged he accepted cash on the pretext he would pay back the city for taser darts expended shooting the party guests. Even before the twin investigations, the relationship between Merrill and Emmett County Sheriff Mike Martins was tense. As far back as 2014, the two had publicly sparred over the amount the city paid the county for dispatching, over jurisdiction, and over the money the city paid for the sheriff's deputies who patrolled the town when Merrill was off duty, according to articles in local newspapers and city council minutes. In September of 2017, after more than a year of investigation, then state auditor Mary Moseman gave her findings. The city's finances were so bad that her auditors couldn't tell whether most of the spending was appropriate or legal. It was not possible to determine if all the collections were properly deposited or if additional amounts were improperly dispersed, she wrote. In addition to the improperly collected city payments, the auditor's office identified about $10,000 in improper payments. Some of those went to Stanton and Evans, they said. Despite the findings, Merrill continued to work as police chief and Baum continued to serve as the mayor and his boss. According to the charges, Baum and Lang continued to conspire to falsify documents. When investigators seized and kept Merrill's computer, the city council protested, asking that it be returned or that the county pay to replace it. Meanwhile, for months, Merrill, as police chief, functioned without access to the electronic dispatch system used to track his own activities. Then, this month, the Iowa Attorney General's office approved and filed criminal charges leading to the arrests. A few days later, the city council suspended Lang and Merrill. After paying bail, Baum submitted a written resignation. Now, the city council faces appointing another new mayor. If convicted on all counts, Baum could be sentenced to as much as 72 years in prison. There already were warning signs about Armstrong's finances before the auditors arrived in Armstrong in 2016. Just the year before, the state issued a report raising concerns about the way Armstrong tracked its finances and recommended changes, including better segregation of duties and determining how many people should be involved in handling different parts of financial transactions. However, that alone did not make Armstrong unique. Auditors have identified similar problems in government entities from tiny towns like Armstrong to state agencies, according to Iowa auditor Rob Sand. It's easy for people to think that this is a bigger problem in small towns, but frankly, Iowa just has more small towns, he said. And while those findings alone don't indicate fraud, it does mean taxpayers at all levels could be vulnerable to unscrupulous officials. People who want to steal money and abuse the public's trust exist at all levels and sizes of governments, Sand said. Moving over now to our second article, written by Ian Richardson, Senate Passes Welfare Reform. Bill would add steps to gaining some benefits. Iowans may soon need to undergo adding verification steps, including checks of their household assets, to receive food stamps and other benefits. The Senate approved the bill, Senate File 389, Tuesday night. It would also instruct the Iowa Department of Human Services to use a computer system to conduct automatic eligibility checks for Iowans on other public assistance programs, including Medicaid. Senate Republicans say that step will streamline the process and reduce fraud. But Democrats said the measure would trip up needy Iowans seeking food assistance, which could be more painful given coronavirus-related needs. The additional computerization is also unnecessary, they said, because the state is already working on updating its system. The Iowa Senate passed the bill on a 30-18 party-line vote Tuesday evening, but it faces an uncertain future in the Republican-controlled Iowa House, where similar welfare reform measures have failed to advance in past years. Senator Jason Schultz, Republican from Schleswig, who has introduced similar bills over the past 4 years, said the state has begun to recognize the need for computerization over the past few years. While Iowa DHS has been working on computerizing the system, he wants the state to go further. If it became law, he said, Iowa would decrease its error rate for food assistance payments. We are moving in the right direction, but this bill would actually move us there quite a bit more quickly, Schultz said. Democrats, however, said adding additional food stamp requirements, such as an asset test, would make it more difficult for Iowans in need. The more rigorous it is, the harder it is to sign up for, and I think it's probably your intention, Senator Liz Matthias, Democrat from Hiawatha, said Tuesday. The nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency estimates approximately 1% of Iowans receive benefits would see their benefits canceled due to discrepancies, equal to 5,999 Medicaid recipients, 793 Children's Health Insurance Program recipients, 68 Family Investment Program recipients, and 1,466 recipients of Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, often referred to as food stamps. If the bill becomes law, it would require Iowa's Department of Human Services to either contract with a third-party vendor or establish its own computer system to conduct identity verification and other services for the state's public assistance programs by July 1st of next year. The system would use a variety of federal and state records to verify eligibility of Iowans applying for assistance programs. If the state contracts with a third-party vendor for the service, the vendor would refer cases that don't pass through to Iowa DHS. When Iowa DHS finds a discrepancy, the agency would provide written notice to the applicant, who would have 10 days to respond. A failure to respond in a timely manner would result in termination of benefit enrollment. Iowa DHS would refer suspected fraud cases to the Iowa Department of Inspections and Appeals for review. It does not give third-party vendors any opportunity to kick anybody off, Schultz said during a subcommittee meeting last week. All it is a tool, a high-tech, efficient tool, for DHS to scrub the eligibility of the list of recipients and find those who don't fit in. Schultz said he believes 85-90% of recipients would slide through the system without needing to provide any additional documentation. Schultz's bill would change eligibility determination for Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Under the bill, Iowans would need to pass an asset test before qualifying for food assistance. An asset test calculates the value of an applicant's possessions, including bank accounts, real estate, and secondary vehicles, to determine the person's eligibility. The asset test would be a departure from current practice. Iowa is among the states that allow people to qualify for SNAP benefits through broad-based categorical eligibility, which allows people who already qualify for other specified programs to receive food stamps. Iowans who qualify under categorical eligibility currently do not need to undergo an asset test, but the bill would change this. Overall, the bill would cost the state money up front, but reduce costs in future years, according to the Nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency. A report estimates that the bill would increase state costs by $1.5 million next fiscal year, but save the state $11.8 million per year after that. Senate Republicans and the groups Americans for Prosperity, Iowans for Tax Relief, and the Opportunity Solutions Project support the bill, saying it will increase efficiency and trust in the state's government. But several local service agencies and healthcare groups oppose it. They say the moves might knock people off the program who aren't native English speakers, who struggle with financial literacy, or aren't tech savvy. At a time when we're seeing increased levels of food insecurity across the state of Iowa, we should really be exploring ways to increase access to food assistance benefits, not creating more barriers and kicking people off programs for which they're eligible for, said Luke Elzinga, the Communications and Advocacy Manager with the Des Moines Area Religious Council Food Pantry Network, said this during a subcommittee meeting last week. Elzinga said he's concerned about the asset test for food stamps. Among the assets that count toward the limit are second vehicles, which he said could disqualify families who need more than one vehicle for work, especially in rural areas. Critics have also said the moves are likely redundant. Janie Harvey, the Iowa DHS Division Administrator of Adult, Child, and Family Services, told lawmakers at last week's subcommittee hearing that the department is meaningfully engaged in these activities already. The state is preparing to comply with federal requirements to participate in the National Accuracy Clearinghouse, a nationwide system meant to prevent people from receiving food assistance in more than one state, by December, she said. The state is also considering a one-year free trial of an income verification product through Equifax, he said. Democrats on Tuesday introduced three amendments, including one that would eliminate the food stamp portion of the bill, and another that would have instructed Iowa DHS to compile a list of employers of Iowans on Medicaid. Multiple Democrats on Tuesday pointed to the increase in food insecurity during the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm sure there's a bill coming afterwards to fund soup kitchens and food banks because right now we're overwhelmed, said Senator Amanda Reagan, Democrat from Mason City, who directs the Community Kitchen of North Iowa and Mason City Meals on Wheels. Schultz said Democrats are blowing many of the concerns out of proportion. The intent of the bill is not to save money by kicking eligible people off benefits, he said. Schultz told the Des Moines Register last week that he's optimistic the Public Assistance Oversight Bill will receive more consideration in the House than in past years. This year, Republicans widened their majority in the House to 59-41, picking up 6 seats. Every single year, I feel better, he said. The idea itself is becoming normalized. And our last article on the front page, also written by Ian Richardson, Senate GOP seeks to curb big tech censorship. Saying big tech companies like Facebook and Twitter are repressing conservative speech, Republicans in the Iowa Senate advanced a proposal Wednesday to outlaw tax breaks for and contracts with companies that censor free speech. These liberal executives out of the Silicon Valley are not going to control what Iowans hear, what they see, and they're not going to censor them, Senator Jake Chapman, Republican from Adel, said during a subcommittee meeting Wednesday. Iowa is among several states considering legislation to govern companies like Facebook and Twitter amid a national debate about the role big technology companies play in the public sphere. Bill comes as big tech companies continue to increase their footprint in Iowa through data center projects and the newly opened Amazon Fulfillment Center in Bondurant, which employs 1,000 people. That means jobs and millions of dollars in incentives could be on the line. Tech groups and representatives of Iowa cities oppose the legislation, saying it would infringe on private businesses' rights and curb economic development. Other critics said Wednesday, if it became law, it could allow other harmful types of online speech to go unencumbered and would have unintended consequences for school districts and universities that rely on technology to operate. This is an imperfect piece of policy, and to advance this could be more dangerous than you think, Senator Liz Matthes, Democrat from Hiawatha, said Wednesday. 30 of Iowa's 32 Republican senators have co-sponsored Senate File 402, which Chapman said would hold big tech companies to a similar free speech standard as the government. Representative Stephen Holt, Republican from Denison, has introduced a companion bill in the House Judiciary Committee. Under the bill, large tech companies could not prevent Iowa citizens from interacting with content that includes constitutionally protected speech. They couldn't restrict the ability of citizens to download social networking sites on a pre-installed app store. And online marketplaces couldn't prevent the purchase of protected publications or merchandise. Social media companies like Facebook also couldn't force algorithms that promote certain posts and bans others. The company could still prevent Iowans from interacting with content that is criminal in nature, obscene, or excessively violent. The Iowa Attorney General's office would have to collect reports of potential violations and would file lawsuits against the companies under the bill. If a court found a company violated the prohibitions in the bill, the company would lose all contracts, benefits, and agreements with government entities in Iowa for a 20-year period. A company could petition the court for a stay after 4 years. Chapman said the bill would apply to existing long-term contracts and tax breaks that a handful of Iowa cities already have with big tech companies that have built data centers. While the company would not have to pay back benefits, it would not be able to receive further benefits through those existing contracts. The bill also includes financial penalties for governmental entities that do not comply. Republicans, social media weaponized by progressive ideology Chapman, and fellow Republican Senator Jason Schultz of Schleswig said Tuesday there have been many instances where social media companies like Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube have shown bias against conservative viewpoints. These platforms have become weaponized by progressive ideology and moved to the point where they will leave anything inappropriate on the progressive side of the nation's ideological spectrum, Schultz said. But they seem to jump immediately like a guard dog against anything that moves toward the conservative side. Chapman specifically pointed to how Facebook and Twitter slowed the spread of a New York Post story in October that, based on unverified emails, alleged ties between Joe Biden and his son Hunter's business dealings with Ukraine. Chapman also said Twitter's permanent removal of President Donald Trump's account was another example of bias. The platform said it did so after the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol due to the risk of further incitement of violence. What would be incredible is if Donald Trump decided he wanted to move to Iowa and was the first case, Chapman told the Des Moines Register Sunday. We'll provide him far more protections than what other states have provided him. While Republicans cite examples like the ones Chapman raises and others surrounding the 2020 election as evidence that social media companies are silencing political views of predominantly conservative users, researchers have said the current body of evidence doesn't support the claim. Earlier this month, New York University released a report calling such a claim unfounded and concluded that conservative voices are actually amplified on social media. A tracker run from New York Times tech columnist Kevin Roos showed Wednesday morning that of the top 10 performing links on U.S. Facebook pages over the last 24 hours, 7, including the top post, were from conservative commentators Ben Shapiro, Dan Bognino, and Dinesh D'Souza. Carl Sasbo, vice president and general counsel at the tech lobbying group NetChoice, who also serves on a task force with the Conservative American Legislative Exchange Council, told Republicans on Wednesday he is also concerned that tech companies are silencing conservative voices, but he said he believes the bill infringes on private business rights. I understand that there is a feeling that there's a lot of efforts to stifle conservative speech, he said, but forcing these platforms, forcing these private businesses to host content that they don't think is best for their users and their advertising is not the right approach. Others said Wednesday the measure would be difficult to enforce. Nathan Blake, Iowa's Chief Deputy Attorney General, said the number of complaints and lawsuits the measure would generate could require a new division within the Iowa Attorney General's office. Even though there's a definition in there, I think it would require a ton of time and effort to police, he said. Blake said there are also potential issues with terminating the existing contracts with tech companies. The Attorney General's office is not registered for or against the bill. Iowa's availability of land, inexpensive energy, water, and fiber optic networks have drawn Facebook, Google, Microsoft, and Apple to central and western Iowa, where they have received approval for hundreds of millions of dollars in tax incentives to support more than $9 billion in data center construction. While Amazon has not located a data center in Iowa, the tech giant in December opened a 640,000 square foot fulfillment center in Bondurant. The project is receiving property tax breaks worth approximately $2.6 million from the city. This bill would hinder job creation and economic growth and ultimately lead companies and people interested in investing in our state to seek business elsewhere, said Brian Waller, president of the Technology Association of Iowa. Robert Palmer, a lobbyist with the Iowa League of Cities, said the group is concerned with the fallout of what could occur within Iowa's communities if some of these deals are voided. Representatives of educational institutions said they are also concerned the bill would void contracts that they hold with tech companies for academic purposes. Some school districts also receive grants and scholarships from tech companies, which Chapman said the bill would void. Keith Sanders, a lobbyist with the Iowa Board of Regents, said the bill would make it difficult for universities to operate. Microsoft operating system is the basis of thousands of computers across our campus, he said. It is embedded in technology, from our utility plants to our hospitals to the scoreboard at Kinnick Stadium. It would literally shut down how we do our business. Chapman said he finds it just as disruptive that these big tech companies are censoring the ability of Iowans to be able to communicate, but he said he's open to refining the bill. With its passage through subcommittee Wednesday, the bill will now head to the full Senate Commerce Committee. A House subcommittee will consider the companion version of the bill, House Study Bill 235, on Thursday afternoon. And with the conclusion of that article, let's take a look at the Metro and Iowa section. Our first story, written by William Morris. Affidavit says, man assaulted officers. Iowa attacked police during Capitol riot. Salvador Sandoval, Jr., who was arrested in connection to the January 6 U.S. Capitol attack, allegedly assaulted multiple law enforcement officers inside the Capitol, according to a new affidavit filed in the case. The affidavit also said the FBI investigators who brought the charges against Salvador Sandoval and his mother received multiple tips connecting them to the January 6 riot at the U.S. Capitol. In the affidavit made public Tuesday, FBI agent Eric Lopez wrote that both Deborah and Salvador Sandoval posted photos or sent videos of themselves on social networks during and after the attack on the Capitol building. Deborah Sandoval, age 54, of Des Moines, shared a video taken inside the Capitol crypt, which investigators were able to match with surveillance footage of that part of the building. In a message sent to another social media user, who later shared it with the FBI, Sandoval stated that, quote, "This is history in the making, save America," end quote, the affidavit said. Her son, who is 23 and lives in Ankeny, shared a video on a different social media platform in which he said he got pepper sprayed in the face and mouth. Got out because I could hear a break and there's still people inside. Investigators match him by his clothing and other accessories to his appearance in Capitol surveillance video. According to the affidavit, the younger Sandoval shoved two law enforcement officers inside the Capitol and attempted to pull free a shield held by a third. The new documents followed the arrest of both Sandovals by the FBI on Friday. Deborah Sandoval has been charged with entering a restricted building, impeding the orderly conduct of government, and violent entry and disorderly conduct on Capitol grounds. Salvador Sandoval is charged with obstructing law enforcement, entering a restricted building, and violent entry and disorderly conduct on Capitol grounds. The Sandovals are two of the four Iowans who have been arrested in the Capitol attack, which led to five deaths and interrupted the official counting of President Joe Biden's Electoral College votes. A judge in the case of another accused Capitol rioter from Iowa, Doug Jensen, wrote that there is little evidence Jensen does not still believe in the use of force to accomplish revolution. The Des Moines Man attained notoriety during and after the January 6 insurrection after images widely spread online showed him confronting law enforcement in the Capitol building and leading a mob that pursued one officer up a flight of stairs. He has been charged with 7 crimes related to the attack, including civil disorder, impeding or assaulting officers, obstructing an official proceeding, and entering a restricted building with a deadly or dangerous weapon. Jensen was previously ordered held pending trial, and at a hearing Tuesday, his attorneys did not contest that decision, although they said they reserve the right to do so if new information emerges. In an order confirming Jensen's continued detention, the judge referenced Jensen's comment to investigators that he is all about a revolution and his adherence to QAnon conspiracy theory. At this point, the court has no basis to conclude that Mr. Jensen's interest in revolution against the United States government and his willingness to use force to accomplish that goal have come to an end, Judge Timothy Kelly wrote. Court records show Jensen entered not guilty pleas to all charges Tuesday. He is due back in court on March 25th. Both Sandovals were scheduled to appear in person Thursday morning in Des Moines Federal Court, before appearing online in District of Columbia District Court that afternoon. Court records show that Salvador Sandoval waived his initial identity hearing and his case has been ordered transferred to D.C. authorities. Both have been released from custody on their promise to appear. A fourth Iowa suspect, Cedar Rapids Leo Kelly, has been charged with entering a restricted building and violent entry to disrupt official business at the Capitol. He has been released from custody and is scheduled to appear next in D.C. court on March 8th. In an interview the evening of the attack, Kelly claimed he had entered the Capitol and took part in a prayer on the floor of the Senate chamber. Nationwide, prosecutors have brought charges against at least 240 people who took part in the riot. 4 people died during the attack, and more than 100 police officers reportedly were injured. Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick died the following day. Isabella Rosario writes our next story from Ames. Student died of alcohol poisoning, hypothermia. An autopsy shows an Iowa State University student found unresponsive last month in freezing temperatures died of hypothermia and acute alcohol intoxication, Ames police said in a Wednesday morning release. Olivia Chutish, 21, was found unconscious at 9:49 a.m. on January 22nd in the parking lot of the Delta 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 sorority at 302 Ash Avenue, and later pronounced dead. Police at the time said she was last seen the night before and believed she had been lying in the parking lot for several hours before she was found. Temperatures on January 22nd dipped as low as 8 degrees in Ames, which was 3 degrees colder than normal for that day of the year, according to the National Weather Service. At 11:59 p.m. the day prior, the recorded temperature was 20 degrees. Chutchess was the daughter of Alena Health CEO Dr. Penny Wheeler and Minnesota State Supreme Court Justice Margaret Chutchess. Born in Guatemala and adopted as an infant, Chutchess's mother wrote in her obituary, "We weren't perfect parents and she wasn't a perfect child, but we were a perfect match. Olivia was the light of our lives," the parents said in a statement. Sharon Evans, ISU Associate Vice President of Student Affairs and Dean of Students, said in a statement Wednesday, "I want to extend my sympathies to Olivia's family and friends during this difficult time," adding that the health and wellness of our students are always a priority. Students and members of Chutchess's sorority are getting support and resources from the Division of Student Affairs and Sorority and Fraternity Engagement, Evans said. She encouraged students to use the university's alcohol education programs, which are designed to help reduce risk. A junior in communication studies, Chutchess died 3 days before spring semester started. Her sorority chapter members are heartbroken, a post at the ISU Tri-Delta Instagram page said. Academic advisor Sabrina Shields Cook said Chutchess always had a smile on her face and an antidote to share in class. Ames Police Commander Jason Tuttle said local police respond to fatalities where alcohol and cold weather are involved once every few years. "If you're going to be out, go out with a plan," Tuttle said. "That includes arranging a ride home before leaving and making sure friends are safely in their homes at the end of the night," he said. Tuttle suggested services like Uber, Lyft, taxis, and Side Ride. The Cyride Moonlight Express offers a free ride on Friday and Saturday nights from 10:30 p.m. to 2:30 a.m. during the fall and spring semesters. Funded by Iowa State and the City of Ames, the bus operates anywhere within city limits. Alcohol consumption causes blood vessels to dilate, particularly the capillaries just underneath the skin. This increase of blood brought to the skin surface gives people a false sense of warmth, heightening the risk of hypothermia, according to the Cleveland Clinic. If you have alcohol in your system, you may feel warmer than what you are, and it wouldn't take too long to probably get disoriented in that type of weather, Tuttle said. Tuttle also highlighted awareness campaigns like Party Like a Cyclone, a collaboration between Iowa State and the City of Ames that aims to reduce alcohol-related risks. The police department wants to have that message going out because the students live in our jurisdiction, Tuttle said. This is a very tragic accident. Across the country, cold weather has proved deadly for other college students, particularly when paired with substances. The Centers for Disease Control reported in 2013 about 1,300 people died each year due to exposure to excessive natural cold. Chuchus is not the only student to have died from hypothermia in Ames. An autopsy revealed Iowa State student John Messina died of hypothermia in 2010. He was found outside the Dairy Pavilion's boiler room, suspected to have fallen down the snow-covered steps and into the door and breaking the glass, causing cuts to his person. Messina had been missing since that January and was found in April, ending a months-long search for the student. Alcohol was not reported as being a contributing factor in that case. University of Iowa student Gerald Belts died of hypothermia in 2019 during the polar vortex. Police said evidence showed Belts had recently used THC. That same year, University of Vermont student Connor Gage died from exposure to sub-zero temperatures, which was exacerbated by acute intoxication. In Michigan, Grand Valley State University freshman Taylor DeRosa was found dead at the end of last year, with an autopsy finding hypothermia to be the cause of death and alcohol being a contributing factor. And another article here from the Iowa State House, Reynolds signs 2.4% K-12 funding increase into law. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds has signed into law a 2.4% increase in per-pupil state aid for Iowa's K-12 schools. The increase, which the legislature passed last week, will add $179 to the state cost per pupil and increase the state's general fund appropriation to schools and area education agencies from $3.381 billion in the current fiscal year to approximately $3.418 billion next year. It is just below the 2.5% increase Reynolds requested in her budget proposal earlier this year. I am proud to once again sign legislation into law that supports our strong public education system in the state of Iowa, Reynolds said in a statement. Our children are our greatest asset, and we have to do everything we can to set them up for success. Our record of increasing school funding year over year shows our commitment to Iowa's public schools. Republicans in the legislature said the move will provide solid funding for Iowa schools, but Democrats said it will underfund education as Iowa has seen a statewide drop in enrollment due to the coronavirus. The state will use district enrollment this year to calculate their level of aid next year. Under the state aid increase Reynolds signed, 137 Iowa school districts will need to increase property taxes next year to make up for a drop in funding due to their declining enrollment over the current school year. Statewide, Iowa's K-12 schools have seen a nearly 6,000 student drop. For comparison, 106 Iowa districts qualified to raise property taxes this year based on declining enrollment during the 2019-2020 school year. The districts facing the largest deficits next year would be Des Moines at $3.9 million, Cedar Rapids at $2.6 million, and Davenport at $1.7 million, according to estimates from the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency. In the Cedar Rapids Community School District, that deficit would mean a property tax increase by an estimated $50 on a home valued at $200,000, said David Nicholson, the district's executive director of business services. Republicans plan to pass more education funding this session. Reynolds had also asked the legislature to pass $20 million in aid to schools for the current fiscal year, in order to provide grants to schools that met in person. The legislature is still finalizing the bill to provide this supplemental funding to help districts with COVID-19 costs. On Thursday, the House passed a proposal that would divide $27.2 million among Iowa's 327 public school districts based on the number of days they held in-person instruction. That bill is now in the Senate. Reynolds on Monday also signed into law $21 million in funding to help purchase a cloud-based accounting system for the state, fulfilling a request she made after federal authorities rejected her attempt to use federal coronavirus funding for the purchase. The state will use the funding for a contract with Workday Incorporated for a cloud-based budget, accounting, and human resources computing system. Iowa originally entered the contract with Workday before the pandemic, but the legislature did not fund the contract in its fiscal year 2021 budget. Reynolds then allocated $21 million of Iowa's Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security, or CARES Act, funding to pay for the project. But she directed the Iowa Department of Management to return it to the state's Coronavirus Relief Fund after the U.S. Department of Treasury's Inspector General said it was not an allowable use of the funding. By the time the state returned it, Reynolds had already spent $4.45 million of the $21 million and asked the legislature to approve the full amount for the current fiscal year. The legislature approved the bill last week. The bill faced opposition from most Democrats, who said that they still have questions about the lack of a competitive bidding process for the contract, and that they did not like that Reynolds had initially used COVID-19 funding to pay for the expense. Brianna Fannin-Steele writes our next article, Grassley to Decide on Re-Election in the Fall. Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley said Wednesday he expects to make a decision about whether to seek re-election sometime in September, October, or November of this year. That's plenty of time to make up my mind, he said on a call with reporters. And in the meantime, I've got a job working for Iowans. I love my work. Previously, he had said a decision might be coming within several weeks. Grassley has been at the center of growing speculation as Iowa Republicans and Democrats alike wonder whether the 87-year-old senator will seek an eighth term in office. Those questions have only grown more pronounced as other Republican senators announced they will not seek re-election, potentially creating openings for Democrats who would not have to run against incumbents. They include Senators Rob Portman of Ohio, Richard Burr of North Carolina, and Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania. Grassley, who won his 2016 election by 24 points, would present a formidable challenge for Democrats looking to claw back congressional power after a round of losses in 2020. So far, no Democrats have said they will run for U.S. Senate in 2022. State Senator Jim Carlin, a Republican from Sioux City, has said he will run whether Grassley seeks an eighth term or not. Grassley said he did not have a comment on Carlin's candidacy, because everybody's got the right to run for any office they want to run for as long as they meet the constitutional requirements. He said that despite his age, he would be 95 at the end of the next six-year term, he has the physical capacity to seek re-election. This morning, I got up at 4 o'clock like I do six times a week and I jogged 2 miles, he said, and if I can do that every day, I hope nobody has any questions about my ability to conduct a campaign. It'll be up to the voters to decide whether or not I should be re-elected, but I hope they won't say I can't conduct a campaign. And here's an article from the Iowa Press Citizen, written by Isaac Hamlet. Tests confirm the cause of death of dozens of geese in eastern Iowa. Eastern Iowa experts confirmed the cause behind dozens of geese falling ill and dying around the Iowa River in Coralville on Tuesday afternoon. Over the weekend, eastern Iowa's KCRG-TV reported dozens of geese had fallen ill, and more had died around the Iowa River Dam in Coralville. At the time, approximately 50 geese had been found dead, and nearly as many had appeared to have fallen ill, although the estimates of how many have been affected have since increased. Over the past few days, the Des Moines-based nonprofit Iowa Bird Rehabilitation, which has helped hundreds of injured or orphaned birds since its founding in 2012, has been caring for several of the birds. We have taken in 52 geese total just in our group, Jenny Boonjakuoko, the group's founder and CEO, wrote in an email Tuesday, but a few other rehabbers have taken in some too. Boon Chuoko said cold temperatures are expected to have impacted the health of the birds, although that's not the root cause behind their death and illness this week. She said tests had confirmed a theory of Iowa Department of Natural Resources veterinarian Rachel Rudin, as reported by the Gazette earlier this week, suggesting the cause was related to the birds' dietary tendencies. As Rudin told the Gazette, a shad-fish-heavy diet, which the geese seem to have adopted due to temperatures that cause shortages of food they typically consume in the area, can cause vitamin B1 deficiencies, which can cause neurological problems and even deaths. We are treating with supportive care fluids, foods, and supplemental thiamine. All geese have shown signs of improvement. We do think symptoms will start to ease with better temps and access to a more typical goose diet. From Indianola, 3 in the running for Indianola mayor. Former mayor resigned in October. 3 candidates are running for Indianola mayor in the March 2nd special election. They are Mayor Pamela Pepper, Stephanie Erickson, and Michelle Fetter-Steen. Indianola's mayor is on the ballot after a saga beginning in October of 2020 when former mayor Kelly Shaw resigned. Indianola City Council appointed Pepper to the position in October after hearing from multiple applicants, including Steen. Later, Erickson helped lead an effort to force a special election for the remaining 9 months of Shaw's term. The Indianola mayor serves for a 4-year term and is paid $6,000 a year for the position. Pamela Pepper is a 23-year-old Indianola resident. A career in higher education fundraising brought her to Indianola to work at Simpson College and serve on the Planning and Zoning Commission for 12 years. City Council appointed Pepper as mayor in October to fill the remainder of Shaw's term. Pepper is an assistant vice president at Drake University. She previously served on council for 7 years in the at-large seat. As mayor, Pepper runs city council meetings and assists the city as it prepares budgets, revives the Civil Rights Commission, Fine Arts Commission, and oversees multiple city infrastructure projects. "I've always thought that Indianola has it all," she said. "We have a lot going on here, and our residents should be very, very proud." Pepper identified strategic growth and infrastructure development as priorities for the city and as her role as mayor. "We want people to come to Indianola and, moreover, our square," she said. "Driving more visitors to our square and our businesses to shop and enjoy our beautiful atmosphere and restaurants." Pepper said her campaign plans include putting up yard signs and emailing and posting on Facebook to connect with voters. She said she is not committing to running again in November, but will spend time thinking about it after the election on March 2nd. 2 elections in 1 year is a lot, but I'm enjoying the job tremendously," she said. Pepper's community involvement outside her office is often through her children who currently attend school in Indianola or have graduated. Stephanie Erickson has lived in Indianola since 2018 and has been active in a variety of roles. A former Indianola City Council candidate in 2019 and employee for Iowa State Senator Zach Nunn, Erickson helped Indianola resident Steve Armstrong gather signatures for the petition that forced his special election. "I totally support Steen and I support Pam. I think it is amazing that we have 3 women on this ballot and that want to be in this position," she said. "I think it is time to heal and we move forward positively together, and I think we are all capable of doing that." Erickson said she is running for mayor because she is concerned about the city's spending and taxes and wants some disagreement and debate on council. She said she doesn't believe healthy debate and conversation is happening. "While I think the city buildings are super important, I think we need to stop being so heavily reliant on our residential taxation, and we need to come up with a stronger economic and commercial development to make up for that tax burden," she said. Erickson also said the city needs to lead by example until the COVID-19 pandemic is over and work more with counties to coordinate vaccine distribution and COVID-19 resources. Erickson said she is also using Facebook, posting yard signs around town and reaching out to Indianola residents to campaign. She said if elected, she will run again in November because she feels 9 months isn't enough time to build trust in the community. She said she could also possibly run in November if the March 2nd election is close and she ends up losing. She also recently committed to donating the $6,000 mayor's salary to a local homeless shelter. Erickson had her first exposure to Indianola when she attended Simpson College, where she met her husband, Josh Erickson. Erickson left her job as a corporate director of marketing and public relations at Wesley Life in Urbandale, so she could care for her child and apply for Social Security to help pay for costs of her care and therapy. "I've been really blessed to be able to stay home," she said. "We don't want to miss any of our children's activities." This led to her being an advocate and lobbyist in Iowa state government for legislation including a bill passed in 2017 to expand insurance coverage for autism therapy. Michelle Federstein is an Indianola native, activist, and salesperson. Her roots in town trace back to before her grandfather, Harvey Mike Fetters, was mayor from 1964 to 1967 and died in office. He was a respected person in this community. "I don't need respect, but I want to follow in his footsteps," she said. Steen said she wants to run for mayor because she wants people in town to think of Indianola as a positive place to live. She said she is focusing her campaigning through a blog website where she informs people of her views and urges people to vote. "I want to be the face of the town where people can come to me with their suggestions and ideas. I want to be someone people can come to, air their opinions, and be involved in some of the city's processes as they decide." Steen said having a voice like hers in city government would be beneficial because she has a long history in the city. Steen has a long list of civic involvement, including helping campaign for Crystal McIntyre for Warren County Supervisor and helping out presidential campaigns for former Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson in 2016. She has never run for political office before. Steen also advocated for the Warren County Justice Center to be at a different location and for the Indianola Downtown Square to be named a destination location in 2012, so the title would be capitalized in local media. "It was to recognize it as an actual location and not just a shape," she said. "It is important to me that people know that what I'm involved in is local and helps people here." Steen decided to apply for mayor in 2020 and now run in the special election to fight negativity she views to be present in Indianola's government. She thinks she can handle any negativity that comes her way. "I want to help people see that whatever is done, there can be a positive impact on Indianola," Steen said. Steen said she would consider running for either mayor or city council in the future, but that decision depends on how she feels at the time. Steen is also a former feature writer for the Indianola Record Herald and the publisher, editor, proofreader, and writer at the City Gate Christian newspaper, which was published from 1995 to 2009. And we'll wrap up the few Iowa statistics on the COVID-19 pandemic. There have been 334,106 confirmed cases, an increase of 723. There are 5,415 deaths, an increase of 15. Hospitalizations are at 233, up from 227. Patients in the ICU are at 57, down from 58. And patients on ventilators are at 23, down from 25. And that does it for the first hour of the Register on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Up next, we'll give a shout-out to all our listeners who are celebrating a birthday today. I'm your reader, Dennis May. Thank you for listening.